Welcome to this first episode of Current Topics in 5G Technology Podcast Series, hosted by Microwave Journal editors Pat Hindle and Gary LaRude. This series is sponsored by Rohde & Schwarz and features one of the top 5G experts in the test and measurement field, Andreas Rossler, technology manager at Rohde & Schwarz. Welcome, Andreas.
Hi, Pat. Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me. I must admit, I had not done a podcast yet, so this is something new for me, too. I'm excited to be on the show.
Well, glad to have you. In this first episode, we're going to cover the current state of 5G rollouts, including the effects of COVID-19, plus the current challenges in 5G technology. Andreas, where does the 5G market stand now as far as rollouts around the world?
Pat, that's a very interesting question. And I think that we have 5G and are now on the air about 12 months, a little more than that, right? The first networks launched in April 2019. So it's an excellent time to recap, I think. So from our perspective, generally speaking, all the deployments out there are still non-standalone mode deployments. That means an LTE anchor is required to exchange signal and control information. I think that's common knowledge by now. However, what we see based on our field testing experience that we participating in still in trials or working with the operators that already launched 5G to optimize it, we see that gradually additional features being activated that's sometimes hidden to the public. But of course, for us in the technology world, this is sometimes a major step forward. So I give you an example here just quickly. For 5G NR, we can now establish the so-called signaling radio bearer free that allows the 5G NR device to send the 5G NR measurement report directly to the 5G RAN, to the GNOTB, which of course helps with handover decisions and optimization and that. And of course, in an eye of a subscriber, that's a very minor feature, even not relevant to them at all. But from a network and handling perspective, I think that's, for instance, a huge step. So we see here gradually more and more features being rolled out into the networks and activated in devices, you know, with software updates and such. But I still think we are at a very early stage worldwide in the rollout of NSA and 5G NR. So with that mode, service providers can not yet benefit really from the advantages provided by the 5G core network as they connect to the LTE core network still, of course. So features like network slicing and therefore the adaptation of the new quality of service flow concepts of 5G all the way down to the air interface, utilizing, for instance, different bandwidth parts that are not yet available. Yeah, so bandwidth part is in general a new concept in 5G compared to LTE, where the available channel bandwidth can be organized into bandwidth parts, each one using different numerologies, in other words, different subcarrier spacings. And that has a direct impact on the latency achievable over the air interface, as in theory, I can move a device from one bandwidth part with a lower subcarrier spacing, say the 15 kilohertz, to a bandwidth part that uses 30 or 60 kilohertz. At the moment, that is not there. From a standards perspective, a device can be scheduled with up to four of these bandwidth parts in uplink and downlink direction. But if with release 15, only able to be active in one bandwidth part at any given time. So if you look at today's logs from commercial deployments around the world, at the moment, each device is only configured with one bandwidth part only. So it clearly shows from our point of view that these initial rollouts, they only use a limited number of features based on the availability of these features and modems and handsets and on the infrastructure side. But there's more to come while we're optimizing 5G. Here at RNS typically say, in that regards, 5G is a marathon. It's not a 100-meter sprint.
Good point. Most of the world right now is pretty fixated on COVID-19 and the shutdown, people staying at home. What's been the impact of that, or what do you see the future impact of that on the 5G deployment from like release 16 and 17 to the move to standalone and some of the spectrum auctions?
Yeah, I think you bring up here a great point, Gary. So it's, of course, hard to answer a question about the rollout as each of the operators has a different strategy to roll out 5G, either using sub-6 gigahertz frequencies or millimeter wave and such. But I think as you ask about release 16 and 17, I think we can give a definite answer from a technology perspective, as this is pretty straightforward from my point of view. So the original time schedule was marked for June 2020 to finish the core specifications for release 16. And as we all know, the Release 16 is focusing on the two market verticals, primarily automotive and industrial IoT, of course, while optimizing the standard for ultra-reliable, low-latency communication application scenarios. So it also brings additional new features which are interesting to the mobile broadband community. So what we're rolling out right now, like power savings, for instance, or positioning enhancements. And of course, not to forget that 5GNR can then use unlicensed spectrum, short NRU. And even for the millimeter wave world, with integrated access and backhaul as a work item in the standard, there's more to come there to introduce a flexible front haul concept to expand coverage for millimeter wave. So a lot to look forward, but like I said, it was targeted for June 2020, and it's now being postponed to September 2020. So 3 months already, just while this communication or the standard community, 3GPP, is moving to, you know, online meetings only. I mean, they didn't move to it, they're already on it, and email discussions. So I think that has a significant impact on when these standards going to be ready. And from experience, we can, of course, tell that it typically takes between 12 to 15 months once we have a feature finished in a standard that we see it actually commercialized in a modem, in an infrastructure site, and then being rolled out to the public. So there's a significant impact from COVID, at least from a technology point of view, finishing these fundamental work that is going on in the standards world right now.
And I've seen some countries are delaying the spectrum auctions too.
Yeah, that's correct. I think here an example is the US with CBRS, where we have the rest of the world rolling out 5GNR using 3.5 gigahertz frequency range, typically bands N77, N78. And the US was looking forward to that. So I think the operators were looking forward to it. But I think since we introducing a very new concept of shared spectrum with different licensee holders, priority access, and then generalized authorized access, I think time is required to make sure this is all working. So that auction is delayed, yes, but it will come. And I think operators will benefit from it and use it then for the 5G and our rollout and mid-range spectrum here in the United States.
Andreas, what do you see the regional differences are there since the rollout in China has resumed, whereas in Europe and US are still kind of on hold?
Yeah, there are significant differences. I think Asia and Europe, of course, are the first one that launched 5GNR based on the already mentioned NSA mode, but using FR1 spectrum, whereas the US, the United States, kind of launched NR using millimeter wave, combining that with sub-6 gigahertz LTE. So two different strategies. I think in Asia and Europe, the TDD spectrum was underutilized or made available to the service providers in time. So these two frequency bands that I think I mentioned already, N77 and N78, were available to the operators so they could utilize that. What we see right now, if we compare that, is of course that we typically see an 80 megahertz or 100 megahertz carrier. Of course, it depends on the operator and what spectrum he acquired during that auction for those particular bands. But those carriers, the 100 megahertz or 80, they use typically 4x4 MIMO. And that under ideal conditions gives us, for that NR carrier, of course, 2 gigabit per second maximum throughput if we use the highest possible modulation coding schemes and self-contained downlink heavy slots, if we just focus on that from a downlink perspective. But I think we are not there yet on the network configuration side either. This is lab-based testing that's being carried out today, but it's not being actually commercialized. So it's not the reality from that point of view. So they also still have the way to go. And that's the same true for FR2 here in the United States, where we deal with an LTE anchor, where we have a combination of 100 megahertz carriers in the 28 or 39 gigahertz band, depending on the operator. Yeah. And technically, these bands and the propagation conditions are only good for 2x2 MIMO in this frequency range. I don't expect there any change in that. And we get these higher throughput that we see in these testing scenarios of early adopters by aggregating these carriers, right? Which we don't have yet on the FR1 side, where we're still dealing with single carrier only at the moment. So there's a lot of room for optimization in both areas. And that, of course, keeps us busy, keeps the industry busy, keeps the test and measurement community busy.
So one of the very unique aspects about 5G is the very significant over-the-air testing. What would you say about the standards? Are they fully defined at this point? And what's the status of the industry actually implementing the standards to test the networks and user devices as the volumes increase?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And of course, crucial to Rohde & Schwarz as a test measurement vendor in general, but as the leading platform supplier for 4G LTE device testing worldwide, we are very concerned about that question. I'm saying that because I think OTA, if we look at the past and how long the industry worked on specification and tried to get agreements in place to do over-the-air testing for LTE, I think sometimes we're rushing it a little bit. And I think if you look at the current status in this specification world, there's still a lot of work to do, especially on the RIM side, on the mobility side, how that's being tested, how beam management procedures are thoroughly tested. And of course, we are contributing to these discussions in the respecting working groups in 3GBP. What we also see right now, a lot of the operators rely on certification, the certification organizations, to do the initial testing of the 5G devices. And we have seen that due to the market demands, we had a big interest in rolling out these devices early. So there were exceptions until January that certification could be done with one device only. Typically, the general rules are that you need two independent devices to validate test cases in RF in protocol. Of course, that is picking up now while more devices are coming out and hitting the market like you said. But I think still we have a long way to go to get the practices in place that we had with LTE and worked on over the 10 years that LTE hit the market and was rolled out.
So as a follow-up to that, how would you compare the sub-6 gigahertz or FR1 testing versus the millimeter wave FR2 testing?
Yeah, from an OTA perspective, both frequency ranges have that aspect. Millimeter wave is only OTA, of course. We have solutions for both. But of course, it's also important to understand that just now we got the initial devices in from the OEMs that actually support, for instance, frequency division duplex, which is essential in the rollout of 5G now for FR1, because 90% of the spectrum below 6 gigahertz is FDD-based spectrum. So a lot of operators, in particular also here in the United States, are looking forward to have these devices and get these into the field. And I think just recently, a few operators here in the States launched FDD-based FR1 deployments and optimizing that while we go. So from testing perspective, we're active in both, and both have the more or less the same challenges supporting the functionality that's required to do 100% testing. And that's what we've been working over the remainder of the calendar year, I would say.
We've seen different test vendors supply different setups. Is that part of it? There are certain standard procedures, but what about the hardware itself? Has that been standardized?
Yeah, there are different configurations that could be utilized for this type of testing. You're referring here to the direct far field methods using a reflector, so-called Qatar solutions. So we have a solution for that. Then there are indirect far field solutions. We also had initially a solution for that. I think the industry is now locking into the Qatar-based solution from a conformance point of view, from an RF conformance point of view, for sure. And the discussions are still going on the radio resource management side, so on the mobility side, where you have to test with different angles of arrivals and such. And that is just being hitting the market now. So I think over the years, we now locked into a more preferred way to do this type of testing, but we still have to push that out to all the different areas of the testing. RF is there, RIM has to follow.
So one hot topic that we're seeing in the market is dynamic spectrum sharing, especially in the U.S. where the capacity is more constrained than other regions. Can you cover, what that is and what effect it has on testing and implementation at the rollouts?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a special topic for me, dear to my heart, and I'm following that since quite a while. So what dynamic spectrum sharing is of course very unique to 5G, so to say, because initially if there was a new G, operator had to assign new spectrum for this rollout of that technology. And as you rightfully said, we have reached capacity on the low band, mid band spectrums. They're heavily used by today's LTE network. So there's basically a big challenge for network operators now to provide a coverage layer for 5G, especially here in the States, where we rolled out millimeter wave, which is a hotspot deployment, where we have dense areas where we need high data rates. But as we all know, millimeter wave don't travel that far, right? So there's no nationwide 5G rollout using millimeter wave frequencies. I think we need to be careful when sometimes I read that this is compared to FR1 rollout. So what is an operator doing about this? He could either switch off LTE in certain bands that would impact the capacity. Subscribers would most likely notify that if you take away a 10 megahertz or 20 megahertz channel and not utilizing that anymore in that specific market. Dynamic spectrum sharing is addressing that. So the idea is really that two technologies, NR and LTE, using the same spectrum and at the same time, more or less, in a TDM and FDM fashion. So that means it's not a fixed static split that sometimes people suggest. So you have a 20 megahertz channel, for example, you split it in 10 megahertz for LTE and 10 megahertz for NR. That would be not very efficient, while still the majority of a subscriber base for an operator is still on LTE while they're being transitioned over to NR. It's really the idea to share this spectrum. And the methodologies introduced for that is a combination of features that allow this functionality. So we need to make changes on the LTE side in the sense that we have a resurrection of an LTE Release 9 feature called MBSFN. So the broadcast subframes, which was the idea to broadcast content in particular subframes when you configure that on the LTE network side that are not used for standard LTE data transmissions. So this feature can be reused. Why is that important and needed? It's basically to allow the 5G NR device to synchronize to the 5G NR signal. So that means that the synchronization signal blocks of 5G NR, the tracking reference signals, the channel state information reference signals, and all that good stuff that is required for the device to be operational is being most likely transmitted in these MBSFN subframes. Of course, that differs between network vendors, and so depends on the operator strategy, who he uses for that. Of course, there's also different timelines involved. I think there have been industry news or conferences where this being discussed. And on top of that, the idea is that 5G NR could use also standard LTE subframes to increase capacity as needed. And here it comes again to the proprietary implementation of the scheduling and scheduling algorithms into the base station, into the radio access networks, which is not defined by the 3GPP standards, as some people may think. So it's a secret sauce of the network equipment providers. And when you read the literature and the announcements, you can see that the situation, the load situation in the cell is evaluated basically on LTE transmit time interval period, so in a 1 millisecond. So that means the schedule will look at how many LTE devices I have in the cell, in my service cell, in service area, how many 5G devices I have, what's the quality of service they require. In other words, what type of services they access. Is this just a call, voice over LTE call, or later on VoNR call? Is this a data session? What's the priorities and such? And based on that, the scheduler can then decide how much of the resources in the frequency domain and in the time domain are allocated for either LTE or 5G NR. And that makes it dynamic, right? And that is what's being deployed. And that's what gains the interest of the network operators that don't have the strategy to set aside spectrum for 5G NR rollouts on low bands by switching off, for instance, an LTE carrier or such.
And so has this presented additional challenges on the test side that you've had to address?
Yeah, of course. It's a combination of feature sets on both ends. First of all, we want to make sure that we didn't break LTE, right? So even traditional LTE-only devices need to work in such an environment. So for that, we need to test on the LTE side, for instance, that once we configure broadcasting subframes in an LTE network, that the LTE device is still functioning as expected. Same for the network optimization sites on LTE. I'm taking subframes off the LTE radio frame, taking them away and making them usable for 5G NR. So if you don't inform a device or the device implementation is not correct, it would still assume the LTE signals there to be present. This is important for the channel estimation, making RSRP, RSRQ, SINR measurements and such. So all that is something that we took care of and tested in lab environment based on devices using our CMW500 and CMX500 platforms. And then, of course, the implementation of 5GNR using standard LTE subframes. There's MAC elements in there, like rate matching, needs to be applied to avoid the LTE cell-specific reference signals, which are omnipresent in LTE standard frames. That is highly dependent on the MIMO mode that's being used, on the bandwidth, on the physical cell ID. So you need to test different configurations on the device, on the modem side. And that's what we've been worked on over the past month and helped our customers with to validate DSS on the chipset side, on the device side, but also from a field testing perspective on the network side.
Andreas, another topic that's come up a lot is carrier aggregation. I saw a recent news release that they were carrier aggregating low band and mid band together to get a wideband signal. How is that working these days and what test complications does it add?
Great question. I saw the same article being published, and of course, this is also something that we work with our chipset customers on now a couple of days. Like I said, gradually these features make it into commercialization. If you read the same article, then you will notice that this was done with a prototype device using second generation of chipsets. I think if I follow the community correctly, commercialization of something like that is expected with the third generation that's currently being worked on and rolled out in samples to OEMs. So I think the testing, of course, on a lab-based environment is going on, but from a commercialization point of view of a feature like that, we're still off. And I think the pandemic hasn't helped with that. But it's good to see these announcements. Of course, that means that the industry is pushing the boundaries forward. And it, of course, keeps us test and measurement also busy to address these needs with our test and measurement gear, in particular, in that case, of course, our CMX500 mobile radio tester platform.
Well, Andreas, a lot of interesting stuff going on this year as 5G gets deployed. And we appreciate your being with us and sharing your insight on these topics. We're going to continue this conversation next month. We're going to explore the sub-6 gigahertz massive MIMO and millimeter wave arrays. We want to thank Rohde & Schwarz for sponsoring this series on 5G technology and encourage you to look for more information on 5G at their website, www.rohde-schwarz.com. You can find a free ebook on 5G as well as an educational video series called Demystifying 5G. We hope you found this conversation interesting and educational. Thanks for listening.